Go to Habakkuk 3.
What does Habakkuk mean? What does Habakkuk mean?
Habakkuk means to embrace in Hebrew.
Embrace.
Embrace. Wow, yeah, it's backward embrace thing. No, he does. How he does it?
I can't even do it.
He goes backwards and he.
Obscene thing.
Habakkuk 3 is one of the readings on the Feast of Pentecost. And it's. The word in Hebrew, the Pentecost is called the Feast or Ha-Azareth, which means the Feast of Cessation, the end, the finishness. And you celebrate during the Feast of Pentecost the empowerment to sing a new song. And the new song's manifestation in your life is one of the wildest concepts that has been ever known to the human race. And that is that you no longer become the subject, or you no longer are the subject of your sentence. The I motive, the empowerment for the abandonment or the begoning of the I motive is there. Everything in your life thus far, for most of you, has been one of how does this affect me? What does this mean to me? The Feast of Pentecost celebrates the shedding of the seed or sperma of God on your flesh so that you are now empowered to no longer live on that basis. The new song has several chapters and verses. The first one is the lack of the I motive. The second one is the escape from cause and effect. The third one is the escape from reward and punishment. And we're going to read a little bit of it, of Habakkuk, and let's start in verse...
Habakkuk 3.
Let's look at, now, Habakkuk 3. We'll start in verse 1. This was probably being read in the temple. This was read in the temple by the high priest. Just to give you the connection, keep your finger in Habakkuk. You won't mind. Go to Acts 2. Acts chapter 2. Christ has been crucified. 10 days ago, he appeared to his disciples for the last time, and he said to them, "Tarry ye a while in Jerusalem until you be imbued with power from on high." They had to go to Jerusalem 10 days before the Feast of Pentecost in order that they would be purified according to the law, because they had been in contact with a dead body, Christ. So by the law, they could not celebrate the Feast of Pentecost in that unclean condition. Understand? That's a mind-blowing one when it hits you. The law said that if you touched a dead body, you had to go through or were in contact or near a dead body. It's within a cubit, which was the length of, it's approximately 25 inches of from the elbow to the tip of your finger. If you were within a cubit of someone, of a dead body, or you were within a cubit of someone that was within a cubit of a dead body, you understand what I mean? It goes on and on. Then you are unclean according to Levitical law. According to the law which Christ said, unless you fulfill it, you have no part of him. So they went to Jerusalem, participated in the cleansing ceremonies with the ashes of the red heifer and the rivers of living water coming from the pool of Siloam. And now the day of Pentecost was come. It was a feast day that every one in Israel, every male, now there's no more male or female, so everyone has to participate in, or they're cut off from the people. And it says, when the day of Pentecost was fully come, in the Greek it says when the day of Pentecost was fulfilled, in other words, when its meaning was finished or fulfilled, they were all with one accord in one place. Now we know, for those of you who have heard me talk about this before, they were of one mind in one accord in one place. Well, the place they were was in the temple, at the porch under the column of Boaz. And we'll see the importance of that when we read the book of Ruth, which is the other reading for the Feast of Pentecost. And it's the porch that led from the court of the Gentiles into the court of women in the temple. They were there in one accord, in one place, of one mind, and that one accord and of one mind was they were scared out of their wits because there was a price on their head. And they went through this massive thing that they knew in their own Jewishness that they had to appear in the temple on this feast day, otherwise they would be cut off from the people. But they also knew that Caiaphas, the high priest, and Herod had said they were all to be jailed. And so they were in a very inobtrusive, trying to sneak in. They were all from Galilee, 120. They were hiding out, trying to mix in with the people in the temple, trying to be unobtrusive, trying to just sort of intermingled. Josephus says there were 6 million people in the temple on that day. 6 million. So you can understand they could sort of merge together and not be seen. They were hiding out, 120 of them.
6 million.
The temple was huge with perfect acoustics because of the harmonics and the golden sky on and the harmonics.
What kind of size is it, roughly? 3 miles?
No. Josephus probably, I mean, very frankly, it was probably around 2 million. But I'm just saying that the historian says there were 6 million, but he was 10, he prone to...
6 million.
He was 6 million evangelistically speaking. You know that the... The evangelists, I mean the radio and television ministers use this formula to define how many listeners, because none of them subscribe to Arbitron or Nielsen. And the formula they use is that every letter or phone call I receive is 1/100 of 1% of the audience. You understand that? I mean, that's how they define and project how many people they listen to on there. Well, when I was on the radio in Dallas here, that using their formula, I had 33 million listeners.
You know, if the Baptist church rolls are right, you know, like the people that go up to the front, the entire world has been saved 10 times over. It's true.
Well, anyway, evangelistic.
And Baptist is kind of like Josephus.
And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Now we know what the one accord was. They were afraid. So fear is not an uncommon thing to be attendant to the days previous to the Feast of Pentecost. And suddenly, while they're hiding out in the midst of the crowd, trying to be innocent, suddenly there came a sound from heaven, as of a mighty rushing wind, and it filled all the temple, what should say, where they were sitting. And there appeared unto them cloven tongues like as of fire, and it sat upon each one of them. So here they're hiding out, and all of a sudden...
Act casual.
Go away. Are you getting the picture? This is not what you've been taught with regard to Pentecost and the upper room and all that. Get out of here, quiet.
Damn tongues of fire. Where's the tongue of fire repellent?
Now, what were those tongues? It was the way it says in the Greek, it says, a tongue of fire appeared, and it separated and sat on each one of these 120. Now, This is vitally important in the law and in Jewish literature and history. It took 120 people to define a new city, a new community.
Oh, neat. I've never heard that either.
And the 120 then defined our first charter.
The New Jerusalem.
Now, there was the sound of mighty rushing wind, but there was no wind. There was an appearance of cloven tongues of fire, but no fire. And what was it? The veil of time was ripped. So that they saw into eternity. And when that veil had that tiny, squeaky little tear in it, it sounded, the tiniest little tear, and was the sound of a mighty rushing wind. And it sat on each one of the 120 that defined then the new Israel, the new Jerusalem. Now, while I'm not exactly at the moment when this happened, but I can show, we'll study when we do Pentecost, we'll study exactly what the high priest was saying when that happened, which is awesome. But just before this, they read, they're standing there in fear. You got it? And they're listening without a whole lot of interest because they're looking around seeing if there's any temple guards or anybody trying to get them. Okay, now, they're reading Habakkuk 3. See if any of you can relate to this. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet upon Shigionoth. Now, Shigionoth, I just mean, that's a musical term that means it's a song that was being sung by this humongous choir. And Shigionoth means it was a variable thing. It was like it, like we do sometimes a little bit where the women sing a part and the men sing a part. Well, this is where they had about 18 times more complicated. Shigionoth is like it's all kinds of complex, interrelated melodies, okay? O Lord, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman. Now, most of you already know this, but the directions of the compass are vitally important in your understanding of the Old Testament and your understanding of the book of Revelation. But Teman is the word for south. God came from the south. Now, north, anything that has to do with north is always the evil one, the Antichrist. Anything to do with south is always the hidden, the mysterious. Anything to do with east is always the forbidden, the Babylonian. And anything to do with west is the process that you inexorably move toward because it's always toward the New Jerusalem, the altar. So when it says, and God came from Teman, it means he, in the spirit, it means he came from the mysterious, the hidden. At the time of Christ's birth, the only constellation of all of the 48 or 12 constellations and 48 decans that go with them in the stars, the only one that looks like what it is, you know, because it's got lions and all kinds of little stuff up there I can never see, but I know, you know, that didn't look like a lion or that didn't look like a... The only one that looks like what it is the Southern Cross. And at the time of the birth of Christ, the Southern Cross sat at the horizon of the South. After the birth of Christ, the Southern Cross can no more be seen in Israel. It can't be seen now in the Northern Hemisphere. So, again, God came from Tema, the South, the mysterious. You got it? And the Holy One from Mount Parsan, Selah. No, I'm not going to, excuse me, that's not right. Paran. I don't want to go into that one. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. And his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand. Now, the word horns could better be translated as laser beams. The word horns means rays of not just light, but in, what's that word? There's another word. In science, you call it monochromatic light. I mean, it's perfect coherent light. That's the horns on the altar. When it talks about tie me to the horns of the altar. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His days are everlasting. His ways are everlasting, excuse me. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Now these are all non-Israel for the time being. Anything in you, this is all symbolic of what's going on within you. Was the Lord displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made quite naked according to the oath of the tribes, even thy word. Thou didst cleave the earth with rivers. The mountains saw thee, and they trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered his voice and lifted up his hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear, thou didst march to the land in indignation, thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of the people, even for the salvation with thine anointed. Thou woundest the head out of the house of the wicked, and this is the head in the house of the wicked, you understand? The Antichrist. By discovering the foundation unto the neck. In other words, now we're, remember I told you before, my only function in life is to reveal the man of sin, the wicked one, which is you. Now notice, everything that is said in this passage was in the past tense. You got it? Thou didst strike through with his staves the head of his villages. They came out as a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was to devour the poor secretly. Thou didst walk through the sea with thine horses through the heap of great waters. When I heard, my belly trembled and my lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered into my bones, and I trembled in myself, that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he cometh up unto the people, he will invade them with his troops. Now, cometh up here means to reveal himself to you. Now, you must be with Job. Job said, after going through all the stuff he went through, he said, God, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee, and I repent in sackcloth and ashes. And then Job's captivity was turned when he prayed for his friends. Now, as we see this, in the past tense, you have to tremble, right? That when you see it, then this is what I believe was being read just before the tongues of fire. All of them had heard the song. I mean, this is not being read, but being sung. They in the temple, all these 2 million, 6 million, whatever number, were the huge, huge chorus was singing a song. And this is what happened just before time opened. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, and the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice the Lord. From the disciples' standpoint, some of them had even seen him. Some of them had seen him three times. Not once did they recognize him. They thought they were experiencing mass hysteria. There was absolutely no empowerment for what they believed they believed. There was only the terrible, terrible doubts and suffering caused, which is the worst kind, caused by the doubts of someone that really wants to believe. From their standpoint, their Savior was gone. They had had some appearances, but it was like as a dream. They were living in fear of their lives. They were cast off. The fig tree hadn't blossomed. There was no fruit in the vine. The labor of the olive had failed. Everything was terrible. Yet will I rejoice in the Lord. Now the word means that yet will I rejoice only in the Lord. And nothing else. I will joy in only the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like hinds' feet, and he will make me to walk upon mine high places. Well, have you been around enough to know the high places are this phony activity that goes on in your brain? And now, through the empowerment of Pentecost, you will be empowered to walk on your high places. They'll have no more power over you. You'll tread your enemy underfoot. Understand a little bit? Well, that's what Pentecost is about in a nutshell. That's the scenario that took place just before the famous one that's talked and taught in all the Pentecostal churches about the empowerment. Fundamentally, the feast of Pentecost is a feast about your tongue. What you speak with your tongue. Okay, let's go to Acts 2. I want you to remember something that the Apostle Peter was a young man, probably 18 or 19 when he began following Christ. He was at this point 21, 22 years old at the most, maybe younger. He was totally uneducated. He was a fisherman. Total blue collar from Galilee, the Galilee of the nations, which was the despised region in Palestine. They spoke, they didn't know how to pronounce Hebrew. There's all kinds of stories. They didn't know how to pronounce Hebrew right. They didn't, they were just dorks.
From the sticks.
The sticks. White trash.
Yeah, Mesopotamian trash.
And he is about to give a speech which, in the annals of speech history, and I mean in studying it and outlining and clarity of logic and clearness and simplicity of preparation, is unparalleled. I mean, there's no other speech like it. So something has taken place here. Something is happening, and let's see if we can figure out what it is. See what's in store for you. He's not, you got to get this picture. These disciples, you are far better equipped than they were. Yeah. What?
She said evidently.
Okay, when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. And suddenly there came a sound from heaven as a rushing mighty wind, and it filled all the house of the temple where they were sitting. And there appeared unto them cloven tongues like as of fire, and it sat upon each of them. Now, I'm not normally a recommender of this Biblical Art Center up here, but the artist that painted that picture is the only one I've ever seen that has it correctly. Every other one, they're sitting around in an upper room, you know, doing stuff. But this guy did it right. They're at the right place under the column of Boaz. They're at the court of women. And it's a great picture. So if you feel like it between now and Pentecost, go up and look at it. Huh? Yeah. It's right up the park in Bodecker. And they were all filled with the Holy Ghost and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now, the first occurrence of Pentecost, it says the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters in Genesis 1. The next appearance of Pentecost, well, there's a lot of others, but the major ones, is the Tower of Babel was destroyed on the Feast of Pentecost so that people could not communicate with one another. Up until that time, there was only one language, and then there were 70. The next, Elisha was given, well, David died in the Feast of Pentecost. And that's another massive importance because it's you after the flesh.
David?
Yeah. Then, well, before that, God gave Moses the Ten Commandments on the Feast of Pentecost. But all of the feasts of Pentecost and all of the activities attended to Pentecost have to do with your tongue. And that's what we'll see here. Let's watch. They were filled with other tongues. I mean, they were filled with the Spirit and he gave them utterance. They were dwelling at Jerusalem, Jews, devout men out of every nation under heaven. And they were there. They weren't dwelling. The word dwelling, they weren't living there. They were there for the Jubilee year. They were there to get their land back. They were there out of greed. Because the Jubilee year, all of the land, this is the only time since Joshua that the Jubilee year was done. They tried to do it at the time of Christ. They tried to, all debts were excused, all slaves set free, and all land returned to its rightful owners. And this was noised abroad in all of the world among all the synagogues. And so they all came back. They want some land. So they're there. All these guys were there because of greed and fear. It's not taught very often in this way. Same reason you're here, by the way.
I was about to say, that was exactly it.
Huh? Because you think you're going to get something.
Oh, cheesecake.
No. Spiritual greed. Now when this was noised abroad, the multitude came together and were confounded, because that every man heard them speak in his own language. When the Tower of Babel was destroyed, the languages were confused, and it was from one language it went to 70 languages. At the time of Christ, here, there were 70 languages in the nations, and now they're all melded back to one. And they were all amazed and marveled, saying one to another, "Behold, are not these which speak ignorant Galatians?" That's what it really says. "And now hear we every man in our own tongue, wherein we were born, Parthians and Medes and Elamites, and dwellers in Mesopotamia and Judea and Cappadocia and Pontus and Asia, Phygra, Pamphylia, in Egypt and parts of Libya, about Crete, the strangers in Rome, Jews and proselytes, Cretes and Arabians, we do hear them speak in our tongue the wonderful works of God." And they were all amazed and were in doubt, saying one to another, "What meaneth this?" Others mocking said, "These men are full of new wine." But Peter, standing up with the 11, lifted up his voice and said unto them, "You men of Judea, and all ye that dwell at Jerusalem, be this known unto you, and hearken to my words." Now again, he's standing in the temple. There's mass confusion. And one man stands up a few days before, you know, a few months before this, at a similar thing. Christ had stood up while they were doing the water ceremony and the wine ceremony at the temple. And from the back at the same place, this is where the disciples stayed when they went to the temple. on the right below the column of Boaz. This is where he taught when he was 12, argued with the doctors. This is where all of the action took place from the disciples. He stood while they were doing this marvelous water ceremony and said, you know, why do you have such joy over a silly ceremony of pouring water into a rock and wine into a rock? And because it symbolizes the outpouring. He that believeth on me, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water, life-giving water to anyone that's around. Now Peter stands up at the same place, next feast, and he gives this incredible speech. And these guys, they're not even supposed to speak in there. I mean, for these are not drunken as you suppose, seeing it is but the third hour of the day. But this is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel, and it shall come to pass in the last days, saith God. I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. That's what he did. That moment, when the time was broken, the sperma of God was shed on all flesh. That means from that moment till now, every human being has been the sperma of God. Sperm cells. Now, God in his, this happened in 30 A.D. Christ was born 2 B.C. This happened in 30 A.D. 40 years later, the temple is destroyed and all sacrifices cease. Why 40 years? Because it gave the opportunity in the justice of God for every man that was alive at this point that did not have this seed of Christ shed upon them to repent and come to the temple. When the last man died that was alive then, at this time, then the temple was destroyed. You understand? So now that meant that by the law, by their works, these men that were alive here still could get it right. Once the temple was destroyed, you can never get it right. So stop trying. You're starting to bore me. And God. You don't have to get it right anymore. All right. I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons, speaking in general, shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. You understand? That's on, he's talking your. But on my servants and my handmaidens, I will pour out in those days of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapors of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon into blood before the great and notable day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now, in another passage in Joel, it says, and it's talking about this, it says, the sun and the moon and the stars shall stop giving their light. Well, they have. The world, from the standpoint of everything about what those purpose of the sun and the moon and the stars and the planets, their only function in being there was to be a sign, a revelation. It's unknown now. The reason the sun and the moon and the stars exist was to show forth Christ in you, the hope of glory. They've stopped giving their light. The world looks at the sun and the moon and the stars. They don't see any light of revelation. I only see a little twinkle, twinkle, little star. How I wonder. You understand? That it's speaking here, they truly have stopped giving their light. All right. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now, the word call upon in the Greek means exchange. In other words, exchange your life for his. You men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs which God did by him in the midst of you, as you yourselves also know. Him being delivered by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. Whom God hath raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that it should be hold of him. Well, that's enough. I don't want to go into the whole speech here, but I want you to hear what's just happened. That is, the first sign of this, the first evidence of his coming, appealed to the ear. It was the sound of a mighty rushing wind. An invisible cause producing audible effects. Next, it appealed to the eye, the appearance of the tongues of fire. As I told you, it should be parting, tongues parting asunder, pieces of flame rested in each, equally. And next, the tongue. Eye, ear, tongue. Now, if you noticed, if you followed and looked and analyzed Peter's life, you will see that it was the evidence of his personality were fearfulness, cowardice, all kind of, I mean, he was not a nice guy. Now, it's replaced by courage and zeal. Wisdom, prudence, confidence, boldness, love, skill, tact.
And then it's like there's no attention at all on his well-being in a situation where he knows that he's under a death threat.
Yeah. There's a professor, Stifler, who wrote a book on the book of Acts. And this is a quote from it. Peter's speech shows the marks of the highest art, the most skillful logic, the most persuasive argument. It is without peer among the product of men, and yet it is the work of a Galilean fisherman without culture or training and his maiden effort. That's all that I can do. Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word, a rhema of God. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. All I can do is speak. As you hear, you will slowly begin to see. And what you see is what you will speak. That's why I keep saying to you, John 14, when Christ said, "He that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do." Now, Pentecost is about this greater work. It's the empowerment for you to see that the greater work is to call forth the new heaven and the new earth. But you have to hear it, and you will see it, and then as you see it, your tongue will speak it, and it shall come into being. That's why we're alive. Now, over the next, well, until the Feast of Pentecost, which is the 28th, and that's what we'll be doing in this group, is studying intently more and more mysteries of Pentecost. Okay?
Okay.
Anybody have anything else?
Can I go back?
Come anytime you want to.
Oh, there's something I never thought I'd hear you say.
Take it, big guy.
It's a miracle, I believe.